Well, it is nobler in the mind to suffer the slings and arrows of outrageous fortune, or to take arms against a sea of troubles and by opposing end them.
That's very good. Did you write that? Is that in Watership Down?
Well, it's very good.
Do you think that lady will bring Joan in or look after Joan?
I'll ask her to.
Just to be courteous, I wouldn't like to leave her out in the cold.
When did you arrive in the States?
On Wednesday afternoon. And then last night, you see, I'd been invited over to speak in honor of Joseph Campbell, the great mythologist, the Arts Club of New York, giving him a dinner for his 80th birthday.
Is that tonight?
No, that's last night.
Last night.
It's reported in the New York Times today on page 4 of the arts section.
Oh, I'll look for that.
You know about Joseph Campbell, do you? Joseph Campbell is a mythologist, an anthropologist, and he is chiefly known for a wonderful book which first came out about 30 years ago called The Hero with a Thousand Faces, in which he synthesizes the entire range of world mythology and folk tales so that you can see that it all makes sense and fits into place. All the stories in the world are really one story. And he breaks this down into its characteristic episodes and qualities. And it was through this book that I learned that God meant me to be a storyteller. Deep spoke unto deep when I met Joseph Campbell. And if it wasn't for Joseph Campbell, those books wouldn't be there on that table now. I would never have written anything. Joseph Campbell has been my mentor and my guide, philosopher and friend, and he's become a friend since Watership Down. But I'd worshipped Joseph Campbell for years before ever I thought about writing Watership Down. But when you've read Joseph Campbell, you understand about storytelling and about the nature of the story and what a story is. And, I mean, some guys are sailors, some guys are automobile experts, some guys are jewel merchants. Storytelling is an old and honorable trade, a vocation. And I'm a storyteller by vocation and by temperament and by nature. God meant me to be a storyteller. But it was Joseph Campbell who enabled me to discover this. And I was enormously gratified when the Arts Council of New York telephoned me in England and said, would I come over and make the speech in honor of Joseph Campbell at his 80th birthday. They flew him from Hawaii.
Oh.
And that's what really brought me to New York.
Richard Adams, you weren't always a storyteller, although inherently you may have been. You were, I know, in the service during World War II.
Keep that little closer.
And you were in the British Civil Service. And actually, you got a rather late start in writing, didn't you?
Well, that's true, yes, because I didn't start writing until my mid-40s. And it was my children who stimulated me into writing. See, I knew I was a storyteller, and I always used to tell stories orally to my children. I practiced demand storytelling the way some mothers practice demand feeding. If ever the kid said, tell us a story, Daddy, I would always tell a story. I could tell a story at the drop of a hat. It might be one of the great stories of the world, like Jack the Giant Killer that everybody knows, but I think it's also nice for families to have their own stories, and they feel these are our stories and nobody else's. I made up various characters who had adventures, and it depended what sort of story they wanted. If it was a funny story, it would be like Richard and Thomas Kitten, who were two naughty kittens who played tricks on their master. And but there were more serious characters than that, various kinds. We had various sorts of character according to what story they wanted. And then one day on a long car journey, they asked for a good long story, a completely new story, they said, to while away this car journey. And I began telling the story of the rabbits, which I improvised off the top of my head as we were driving along. Well, the story wasn't finished at the end of the car journey. So it had to be finished on morning trips to school, when I drove the kids to school in the morning, which used to take about 15 minutes. And it wasn't for about 3 weeks that the story was finally finished, the great saga of the rabbits. And they said, "You ought to write that down, Daddy, you know, that's too good to waste." I said, "Oh, now give me a break." I said, "Look, I'm working in the civil service from morning till night." And I said, "Anyway, it takes a long, long time to write a book." I said, "You know, it takes over a year to write a book properly, and you'd have forgotten about it long before ever the book was written." But they were very, very persistent. They kept on and on at me. And one night I was reading them a book at bedtime, and it was a very bad book. And finally I threw it across the room, and I said, "My God, I could write better than that myself." So 9-year-old Juliet said acidly, "Well, I wish you would, Daddy, instead of keep on saying so." So thus spurred and poked, I went out and bought some legal paper and began writing in the evenings after supper. And lo and behold, after 18 months, there was Watership Down. And I topped it and tailed it and got it typed. And because I always write with a pen and ink, I can't work with a typewriter. And then I couldn't find a publisher, and I thought, "Well, God damn it, I'm not expecting very much from this book, but at least, having taken all this trouble, I'm going to find a publisher. I will at least have a modest hardback edition, and I can give a copy to my kids and say, 'There is the book you asked me to write.' That's all I want, nothing more. You know, 2,000 copies, and give me half a dozen, and I'll be perfectly happy." The book was rejected 7 times in all. It was rejected by 4 publishers and 3 firms of authors' agents, including the biggest firm in Europe, Curtis Brown, who wrote me a letter explaining why the book was a non-starter. Finally, the book was accepted by a very, very small-time publisher who had hardly any capital at all and couldn't even pay me in advance. And once it came out, that was when it started. This publisher had no money, he had no particular promotional things he could do, but one thing he could do, he got a review copy onto every desk in London that mattered, and then the reviews began. And then Watership Down never looked back from that moment.
What a remarkable...
It's a strange story.
Yes, it is.
Strange story.
What a remarkable... debut that was. What was your role in the civil service?
Well, I was a local government man. Of course, not everyone is a local government man. Some guys are in the Ministry of Defence, and some are in the Foreign Service, and this sort of thing. But I was always a local government man because
What does that mean exactly?
Well, you see, the way our State Department works, I don't know how yours works, but the way ours works is this.
Nobody knows how ours works.
Oh, well, I'll explain a little about the British State Department. You see, the different departments are rather like regiments in the army. You sit the competitive exam, and then they offer you a post if you're successful. And there's the Ministry of Housing and Local Government, there's the Ministry of Agriculture and Fisheries, there's the Foreign Office, there's the Treasury, there's the Ministry of Education, and so on, you see, dealing with different branches of public administration. Well, I was offered an appointment, a good appointment too, when I'd sat the exam, and at the age of 28, because 5.5 years came out of my life in the war, you see, the age of 28, I took my degree at Oxford, and simultaneously, I took the civil service exam, and I was offered a good appointment in the Ministry of Housing and Local Government. And that's like joining a regiment. I mean, like guys who join the tank regiment learn about tanks, and guys who join the infantry learn to be infantry. Well, I became a local government civil servant. Give me a town clerk, give me a borough surveyor, and it's a world I live in. It's an air I breathe. I know about local authorities, local councils, and I know about the world of English local government. It's a quiet, grey world, but a very nice world of honest, true men and decent fellows. And I lived and worked in this world for 25 years, finishing up as the head of department in charge of air pollution for the whole of England and Wales. This was quite a senior appointment, you know, with direct access to ministers and that sort of thing. I enjoyed that very much. I was 6 years head of the air pollution department in England, and in London. And I'm very proud of the fact that I put an act through the House of Commons and the House of Lords. I put a bill through Parliament, which is now part of the structure of clean air in England. This is the Clean Air Act 1968. Because behind every bill You know, when a member of Parliament gets up in the House of Commons and says, Mr. Speaker, I beg leave to introduce this bill. Well, behind that is some civil servant who has made jolly sure that that bill makes sense and is good law and is not going to give rise to problems and troubles if it's passed. And he can tell that member of Parliament, he can answer every question. And he sits up in a box writing little notes which he passes to the MP. Well, I did that. I got that Clean Air Bill 1968 through the House of Commons and the House of Lords, and that bill never gave rise to any troubles. There were no bugs in the system when that bill became an act, when it became law. Usually, when a bill has become law, then the troubles begin. You get letters, you know, dear sir, I am the town clerk of Halifax. I am puzzled over section 16 of the bill. And you think, oh, Christ, why didn't we think of that? Well, there is nothing of that at all. My bill went right through, and it's now the Clean Air Act 1968. And I feel very proud of that.
Richard Adams, back to your writing a little bit. Shardik, your story of the bear is an extension of the smaller world of the rabbits, quite an extension, and obviously it paved the way for... you have to pronounce it, I mean...
Maya.
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 That's what I thought.
Maya.
Maya.
Yes.
It paved the way for Maya. But in between, of course, there were other books. The Girl in the Swing is something completely different from
it
the
is
other
indeed.
Books.
And I'll tell you something very interesting, Don, about The Girl in the Swing. In England... as you probably know, we have just had something of great benefit to all professional authors, and that is the public lending rights system that's been introduced. Every year, they extrapolate by taking figures from a sample of 20 big public libraries in different towns. They extrapolate as near as they can the number of times that a book has been taken out of the public library every year, and you get a penny a go. Well, this adds up to quite a bit, you see, if you've got a big bestseller. Watership Down makes me several thousand pounds. Now, I just had my public lending rights for last year through the other day from the office, where it's all done, and they gave me the figures in terms of money for my different books, and just for fun I extrapolated them into what we call a thermometer chart, you know, the kind of thing you often see, you know, this sort of thing. What I've done, listeners, is to draw a little series of columns, the highest column being Watership Down in terms of public borrowings. Now, The Girl in a Swing, in terms of public borrowings from the public libraries, was two-thirds as popular. That is to say, for every time Watership Down was taken, every three times Watership Down was taken out, The Girl in a Swing was taken out twice. So that is my second most popular novel.
Probably surprised a lot of people, though.
Well, I think they thought, well, we thought this guy wrote about rabbits, but this is pure erotics. You've read the novel. It's a very erotic novel.
Yes, it is.
There's a lot of very explicit sex. I'll tell you how it came about.
And Maya has...
Maya's very explicit sex, too. Somebody took me to see O Calcutta, and I came away quite disgusted with O Calcutta. It seemed to me like little kids scrawling on a lavatory wall or something. And I said to my friend, well, if that's erotic, I can do better myself. I will try and write a novel which will express something of the sheer beauty and joy and dignity, if that's not too strong a word, of physical love. I set out quite deliberately to write a novel about the joy of erotic love. It's a ghost story as well, as you know, pretty powerful, pretty terrifying ghost story, actually. And people have, I remember one girl who told me she finished The Girl in a Swing at 2 o'clock in the morning, and she was afraid to go upstairs to bed. But that has been a very, very popular novel of mine.
Let's go back to Beckland. Am I pronouncing that right?
Beckla. And the adjective is Beckland. The Beckland Empire.
Yes,
the city
Beckland
of Beckla.
Empire. Beckla. All right, let's go to Beckla, because that first materialized in Shardik, and of course plays a gigantic role in Maya. This is a world that you created almost from the bottom up. But tell me a little bit about, of course you are a natural storyteller, so it's not unusual that you would do something like this, but It sounds like a very ambitious project because you've created everything from top to bottom.
Well, that is true. And I think, Don, that this is really largely a matter of disposition and temperament. I think the storyteller, no less than the surgeon, shall we say, or the sailor, has to have a particular temperament so that whatever talents he's been given by the good Lord are directed towards what he's best able to do. I mean, you know, a cowboy has got to be fond of horses and know something about them and have a feeling for them, that sort of thing. I have always, from my infancy, had a big fantasy life. As I was a rather solitary little boy, I was the fourth child of my parents, but the third child died. Robert, he died before I was born in the great flu epidemic that followed the First World War. Spanish influenza swept across Europe, killing hundreds of thousands of people, among them my poor brother Robert. He was 2 1/2. So I was a replacement for Robert. So I was 9 years younger than my sister and 7 years younger than my brother. That's an awful gap when you're a kid. So I was rather a solitary little boy. But we lived in the country, and we had a big garden, a big half-wild garden. It had a little wood, it had a great meadow, it had huge rhododendron bushes where you could lose yourself. And I had an infancy that was full of solitude and fantasy, but was not unhappy, for my parents were happily married, and they both loved me and were kind to me, and they read to me a great deal. So my infancy consisted really of two things, of being out of doors, playing solitary, imaginative games in the great half-wild garden by myself, perfectly happily, and being read to both by my father and my mother, so that there was always plenty of fresh stuff coming into my imagination, and I had plenty to work my imaginary games out on. And fantasy came quite naturally to me, really. I never thought twice about it. I mean, these were before the days when words like extrovert and introvert had been invented. And I was a very happy little boy playing games in the garden and having all the right books read to me, Beatrix Potter, Pooh, Treasure Island, Dr. Dolittle. My father used to read to me by the hour sometimes. And that's where it all started. That's where it all came from. As soon as I could write myself, I began scribbling away. And my parents were very indulgent in this respect. They encouraged me and said it was very nice.
Did you begin to create your own vocabulary?
I don't know if I did, but I did create my own imaginary kingdom. The garden existed on two levels. It was the garden, all right. I knew where all the flowers and birds were and that, but it was also an imaginary kingdom of which I was the king. It was called Bull Banks. Bull Banks was an imaginary country of which I was the king, and it was peopled by imaginary people. My chief friend was an imaginary person called Stonepath. Stonepath and I had wonderful adventures together. So the creation of imaginary worlds really started almost before I knew what I was doing at all. I never really thought twice about it. Fantasy was just part of the air I breathed. And my parents were very good about this. They never tried to tell me to snap out of it. And they took my fantasies quite seriously. I mean, if I went to my mother and said, Stonepath's got a nasty cold this morning, she'd say, oh, what a pity. Well, perhaps you'd better stay in bed, you know. And this was very nice. I had a very happy childhood. And a childhood full of fantasy, in which one was encouraged, really, to develop one's imagination. If you wanted to pretend you were Jim Hawkins, your father was quite ready to be Long John Silver. So really, I had, you could almost say, the ideal childhood for a potential writer.
Well, Richard Adams, as you began your writing career, obviously by this time you were an adult, a mature adult, and there are certain practicalities involved in writing. You had to not just spin off a fantasy as you did with the children in the car, but you had to physically lay out a land, for example. Mecla is in the maps in both Shardik and Maya, so you had to sit there and draw the map and plan where places are. You had to, well, the vocabulary we talked about, the very unusual words that you have created. So it took a lot of practicality in achieving this.
To me, it's a game. I mean, like I hope this doesn't sound conceited and arrogant. It's not meant to. It's just the first thing that comes into my head. I understand that Bobby Fischer was a rather unhappy child, and he escaped into the world of chess, and he said to someone, I just want to play chess and play chess and play chess. That, to me, that's the answer to everything. And Bobby Fischer played chess. He never did anything else. And when he was 16, he was the world champion, or jolly nearly. To him, it was what he wanted to do. And the things that are so difficult to other people on the chessboard were the breath of life to Bobby Fischer. To me, the creation of the Becklin Empire was what I wanted to do. It's what I was doing, what I knew I was meant to do. And I don't think anyone can find any inconsistency in the Becklin Empire. It's completely consistent right the way through. It's three-dimensional. I was doing what I wanted to do. The same as a sailor likes sailing a ship.
All right, well, tell me how you do it. I mean, do you sit there and make lists to refer to? The cast of characters in Maya stretches something like 4 pages. I mean, how can you remember everybody unless you make diagrams for yourself?
No, it's all in my head. It's part of the game. It's a game you're playing. And of course, some of the characters come into existence as the story is told. Because I am primarily a storyteller. Now, this is an important distinction because not all novelists are storytellers. My great friend Iris Murdoch, a novelist I admire very much, and she's become a great friend, and she told me once that she wasn't really terribly interested in narrative. What she liked was the interplay of character. Again, I'm sure you'd agree that Jane Austen, the story is not a, doesn't matter very much to Jane Austen. What she likes is the interplay of character. People don't remember Jane Austen's stories so much, except that the heroine married the hero at the end. It's the wonderful characters and the wit. The books. But you see, I'm different. What I want to do is to tell a story. What is going to happen to the guy? The essence of fiction is that the reader should wish to turn the page. What the hell is going to happen next to this guy? Is he going to get off the burning train or not? I am a storyteller. And as such, I regard myself as a member of a very, very, very old and honourable profession. Perhaps not quite the oldest profession in the world, but jolly nearly. I've been to India in the war, and I've seen these guys sitting in the bazaars telling stories by word of mouth. Illiterates, you see. Nobody can read and write. And you can see these people. They're too poor to go to the cinema. The storyteller's still got a job in India, and I've seen them sitting there telling the story. And they'll get to the most exciting part, and then they'll say, right, pass round the hat. And everybody puts in a small coin, and if the chap thinks it's enough, then he goes on with the story. And some storytellers are famous. They say, well, have you heard old Rabbi Ben Ezra, or whatever. I didn't mean to use the word rabbi. I'm sorry, I apologize to Jewish listeners, but I was just trying to make up an Oriental name, Abdullah Ben Mohammed or something. These storytellers are famous in their own right. They still are in parts of Western Ireland, which is still very primitive. But the storyteller, the guy who can tell a story in such a way that people say, yes, yes, and what happened then? Go on, don't stop. And I could do it when I was a boy at school. I used to tell stories in the dormitory before lights out. When we got into bed, you see, we'd cleaned our teeth. We had a little while we could talk and amuse ourselves before the master came round to shut us up for the night. And, you know, the master would come round and say, well, right now I think it's time these lights... Oh, no, Sir Adams is telling a story, so just another 5 minutes, sir. Well, you feel marvellous because you feel you're doing what you were meant to do, like a, Babe Ruth making a home run or something. You get a hell of a kick out of this. I'm not in it for the money, really. I've no objection to making the money, obviously. Dr. Johnson said no one but a fool ever wrote but for money. It's nice to have the money, but it's far nicer to have the fan mail. Or when your lady outside came up and said, Mr. Adams, I love your books, will you sign these copies, and then you feel you're doing what you were meant to do by the good Lord. Yes, and it is hard work making up fantasy worlds, and Maya was an enormous labor. It took 4 years to write Maya. But it's what I was meant to do.
More than 1,000 pages. That is an epic.
It's more than 1,000 pages, but in case the listeners are put off by hearing you say that, I'd like to say, I'm here to tell you, that Maya is a very easy read. The point of Meyer really was, I thought I would like to try something on the lines of Sir Walter Scott. Sir Walter Scott, who had no competition, of course, from television and radio, he wrote great big long novels that would keep people happy for a good long time, and they'd want to go on reading. Meyer, the ideal reader for Meyer, would be a wife whose husband had gone to the wars, or maybe a student who'd just come to a strange city and was still a bit lonely and a little bit out of his depth, but somebody who has a certain amount of time on their hands, maybe somebody who's convalescing from an illness and likes to go to bed early, someone who is prepared to give the book, let us say, an hour a day, a nice, long, easy read. Okay, it's 1,000 pages. The point of that is simply to give more value for money. It's a long story, and I'm willing to bet that it's very readable. I think anybody who gets 100 pages into Meyer is going to finish it.
Richard Adams, now, tell me the truth. Are your children as hypnotized with your stories today as they were when you were driving them to school and telling them about the rabbits?
Well, now, you've got to give me a break, because those children are now, let me do a quick bit of mental arithmetic, 27 and 25, and both married. And happily married. You may have noticed that Meyer is dedicated to my two sons-in-law. A guy's sons-in-law are a kind of a lottery. He takes his chance on that. I happen to like my sons-in-law, and they like me. And I dedicated Meyer to my sons-in-law, in whom I consider myself fortunate. So maybe my daughters are a little old now for stories about rabbits. But I expect there'll be some grandchildren along in a minute, and they could have some rabbits.
Absolutely. Do you come in contact with Brian Aldiss?
I have done.
It's because he is not dissimilar from you. He also creates his Heliconia, trilogy. I think he's coming out with a third one. And he's done much of the same thing.
I love other people's fantasy worlds. Tolkien, I think, is wonderful. And C.S. Lewis with his Narnia stories. I think that's a wonderful fantasy world, Narnia. Yeah. Walter de la Mare also was a great fantasist, and he wrote a wonderful book called The Three Royal Monkeys, in which he created a fantasy world. This was a powerful formative influence on my youth as a boy.
In some of the biographical material that was given to me, there are references to Richard Adams as carrying on the mantle of Tolkien. Would not surprise me at all.
I'd say that was superficial. I don't think my rabbits... you see, people always say, oh, you're a fantasy writer, as though this puts you somewhere apart. But in fact, if you come round the author's side of the net and play the game from his end of the court, it's all fantasy. It doesn't much matter whether you're writing about hobbits or rabbits or clergymen in Barchester, or detectives like James Bond, or if you're writing a story about real people living in New York. From the writer's point of view, it's all fantasy, because you've got to make it up and invent it all. Do you follow? There isn't all that much difference from the author's point of view between a fantasy and a realistic novel, because to him it is all fantasy. But I can see that it's very different from the reader's point of view.
Well, Richard Adams, I thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. I hope Maya does well. And when is the pub date, incidentally?
When is?
The publication date?
The book is already out and in the shops and has been reviewed. It's had glowing reviews in the Washington Post and the New York Sunday Times.
Yes, I've seen the reviews.
And it seems all set for a great time. I'm very, very happy with Maya. She's a heroine I love from the bottom of my heart, and I hope the public are going to love her, too.
I know the public will, and thank you very much for coming in and talking to me. Hang on a second.